Micah chapter 5, the first six verses. Marshal your troops now, city of troops, for a siege is laid against us. They will strike Israel's ruler on the cheek with a rod. But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from old, from ancient times. Therefore Israel will be abandoned until the time when she who is in labour bears a son, and the rest of his brothers return to join the Israelites. He will stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they will live securely, for then his greatness will reach to the ends of the earth. And he will be our peace when the Assyrians invade our land and march through our fortresses. We will raise against them seven shepherds, even eight commanders who will rule the land of Assyria with the sword, the land of Nimrod with drawn sword. He will deliver us from the Assyrians when they invade our land and march across our borders.
So today we're going to dig into those verses that Sally read us from Micah chapter 5. But before we do, I just wanted to give a little bit of background to this book and perhaps to Micah as well, because I think understanding who he was and where he was helps us to then understand what he writes. And so Micah, as Sally said, is one of the prophets towards the end of the Old Testament. And Micah, he was a prophet who lived in the southern kingdom of Judah. So on this map, you can see the nation of Israel has been split in two. And following King Solomon's reign, his son Rehoboam took over as king of Israel, which was one nation. But Rehoboam wasn't a very wise man, wasn't a great king, and he heavily taxed the people and really kind of got their backs up. And so what happened was the southern part of Israel, there were two tribes there, Judah and Benjamin, they decided to split away from the rest of the nation. So you ended up with two tribes in the south, and then 10 tribes in the north. And the north took the name, because they were kind of bigger in terms of the number of tribes, they took the name Israel, or sometimes they're called Ephraim, because the biggest tribe in the north was the tribe of Ephraim. And the southern territory, the southern kingdom, became known as Judah. So you had Judah in the south and Israel in the, or Ephraim in the north. And then that kind of barrier kind of in between. And so Micah was a prophet at this time, around the same time as the prophet Isaiah, living in the south where Jerusalem was. And Micah speaks on behalf of God. That's what prophets do. They speak the words of God to the people. And he accused them, both kingdoms, of wandering away from God, of turning their backs on him, of corruption, of abuse, of neglecting the poor. And he says God's judgment is going to come on Israel as a whole, on both kingdoms. He prophesies that the Assyrians first, who were like the superpower at the time, he says the Assyrians are going to come, and they're going to come from the north, and they're going to wipe out kind of the northern kingdom, and they're going to really harm the southern kingdom. And then he says, after them, the Babylonians will come, and they will come through to the south, and they will totally wipe out the southern kingdom. They're going to destroy Jerusalem. And he also says you're going to get taken into exile in Babylon. And if you know your Bible, if you know the book of Daniel, Daniel and his friends are some of those who get taken into exile at that time. Not a great encouraging word for Israel, for either kingdom really, knowing that this is going to happen. And of course, with the hindsight, with history on our side, we know that that's exactly what happened. The Assyrians did come, the Babylonians did come. But towards the end of the book of Micah, he gives a message of hope. He says, although these terrible things are going to happen, someone is going to come. There's going to be a new king. He's going to be born in the line of David. He's going to be born in Bethlehem, and he will rule from Jerusalem. Micah is prophesying the coming of the Messiah, the one that Israel, God's people, have been waiting for. This person who's going to re-establish them, who's going to come and redeem them and rescue and deliver them from other powers. Their saviour. And if we fast forward to the Gospel of Matthew, which comes just a little bit after Micah in our Bibles, Matthew records the birth of Jesus in great detail. And in recording the birth of Jesus, he quotes what we've heard read to us in Micah. He quotes those exact words. And he says that this one that Micah is talking about has been born, and it's Jesus Christ. So we know, using those passages in Micah and also putting it together with what Matthew writes in his gospel, that this one who Micah is prophesying, this king who's coming, who's going to be born in Bethlehem, who's going to be the Messiah, is Jesus Christ. Now, there's lots we could delve into in what Micah says, but we haven't got loads of time. But we are going to look at two things about what Micah writes, two things that they tell us about Jesus. And we're going to look at the fact that Jesus is our ancient king, but also that Jesus is our future king as well. And then we're going to ask the question, well, how can we make him our king today? The ancient king, the future king, and our king today. So the first thing we're going to look at is that Jesus is our ancient king. It writes there in Micah 5, "But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small amongst the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from old, from ancient times." Now it's interesting, isn't it, at the end of this verse, that it tells us that this new king, that Jesus, is going to be born. He's going to be born in this insignificant, small little town called Bethlehem. So Micah's saying this is going to happen. This is still to happen. But then at the end he says, but he's from ancient times, he's from old. This idea of that this king is going to come who was, but also is returning. It's a strange kind of thing for Micah to write, isn't it? That he was the king and he's from ancient times, but also he's still to come. Now it's interesting, in our world, in our culture, it's full of stories that people have written and that people tell about a hero, a king who is going to return. A king and a hero who was in power and was saving people, but is going to come back one day. Now I think if you had a time to think now, if you want to pause, just think of which stories or which films use the idea of a hero or a king who returns to win the day. You know, ones that I've thought of, I love Star Wars, and that's the kind of the essence of the Star Wars films, that kind of these heroes who look like they've been defeated or all disappeared, who come back to save the day. Sorry if that spoils it for you. But even kind of older myths and fables, the Robin Hood story, waiting for good King Richard to come back and rescue the people from the Sheriff of Nottingham. There's others. Shakespeare's play Macbeth talks about Malcolm the king coming back. Even films that are in the cinema at the moment, the whole Black Panther series is all about this hero who looks like he's gone but comes back. All is not lost. And of course on the screen there, the stories of J.R.R. Tolkien, his Lord of the Rings series. It literally has that book and then the film, The Return of the King, the good king who comes back. Our world, our culture is full of these stories. But why is there such power in these stories. Why is our culture, our world, obsessed with these kind of stories? Why do they move us so much? I want to suggest they move us so much because they remind us of the story of the ancient king that Micah talks about here. They remind us of God's bigger story. The king, the ancient king who was, who is, and is to come. Now, Tolkien, who wrote the Lord of the Rings series, you may know, was good friends with the author C.S. Lewis as well. There's Tolkien with his pipe and C.S. Lewis next to him. And they were great friends. They were both professors at Oxford University, both literary professors, both writing stories. And their paths would cross and they were firm friends. And to begin with, Tolkien was a Christian, a believer in God, and C.S. Lewis was kind of trying to find God and had loads of questions. And so they would go for these walks and they would talk about their books and they would talk about faith and life and other things. And Tolkien would share his faith with C.S. Lewis. And in all the biographies of these men, you can read stories about these conversations that they had. And on one occasion when they were walking, C.S. Lewis was saying to Tolkien about these myths and these fables about good conquering evil. And C.S. Lewis says to Tolkien, "Why am I so moved by these stories of good and evil?" And C.S. Lewis, a very modern kind of guy, said, "You know, they're not true. They're just myths. They're fables. Yet they do something in my heart. They move me. Why am I so moved by what are essentially lies?" And the famous line at this point from C.S. Lewis is he says, "They are lies, but it feels like they're breathed through silver. That although they're not true," he says, "there's something magical about them. They're breathed through silver." And Tolkien turns to him and says, "Well, they're not all lies, my friend. They're not all lies." And Tolkien is reported to have said to him, "What about this for a story?" And he says, "Picture a world that's under the force of evil, that is enslaved by evil. Let's call it sin." And he says, "Picture a God who can't stand that happening to the world he's created. So he sends his son, his only son, into the world. A king who's born into poverty, who leads a largely obscure life. Who grows up and becomes a man. And then starts to teach and to stand against this force of evil. He stands against it in social places. He stands against it in cultural places, in political places, in the spiritual world as well. He stands against the superpower of the time, Rome, and speaks against them. He stands against the religious powers of the time, the Pharisees, and he preaches against them and accuses them of not having hearts after God. And these powers respond and they start to push back against the king's son. And eventually they arrest him. They put him on trial. And they execute him. It looks like the king's son, God's son, is defeated. The king is dead. Until, Tolkien says, he breathes again. He comes back to life. He defeats the greatest superpower, death. The hero lives. From the brink of defeat, there is victory. And now he's bringing his people together and renewing their lives. And one day he will renew the whole world, the whole of creation. And it's reported that C.S. Lewis turns to Tolkien and says, "Well, I've never heard it put that way before." Why is there such power in the stories and the myths and the fables and the films that we watch? because they're all a reworking of God's biggest story of all. Have you ever found that? That maybe when you're reading a book or you're watching a film or you're hearing a story, that you think, that reminds me of Jesus, that reminds me of God's story. This is why. Because they're all just a reworking of God's bigger story. The story of the ancient king. The one who is of old. The one who is of ancient times. Jesus is the underlying reality of all these stories. He's the returning king. He's the one that our hearts long for. But his is not a fantasy. His is not a myth. His story is history. He was really born. We're told it here in Bethlehem, Epaphra. He is a fact. So we read these stories and we're moved because there is a memory deep inside every human heart which longs for Jesus and his return. And so we write stories about it. And so we watch films about it because there's something in every one of us, even if we don't really know that. It's like we're all a compass looking for our true north. And we're spinning looking for true north. And our true north is Jesus, the ancient king. And so whenever we detect that, we kind of spin towards it and kind of go, our hearts move towards it. And we go, oh, that resonates. That makes sense to me. Because Jesus is the ancient king. We all have a memory of him. We're all made in his image. He's the one, the king we're all looking for. Jesus is our ancient king. But he's also our future king too. Now Micah is sharing, as we've seen, this tough news for Israel. He says that the Assyrians are going to come and they're going to hit the king with a rod on his cheek. They're going to beat him up, in other words, and that happens. It's true. And he says the Babylonians are going to come and they're going to bulldoze you as well. But there's that hope that this ruler, a king, is going to rise up, is going to deliver them. A future king, he says, is coming. You can imagine Israel at the time and those living in the south in Judah and those living in the north in Israel or Ephraim kind of going, well, there is hope. That sounds pretty bad. It's going to be really rough for a number of years, but that's great. Someone's going to come and he's on David's line. Well, David was our best king. So if he's anything like David is, he's going to build us up to be a strong political force and to be a military force again. And we will become the superpower. Israel, the two kingdoms will be united and we'll become the big country in the area. But that's not what this says here. It's not what Micah writes. He says somebody is coming. But look what he writes. He says he will stand and shepherd his flock, that's Israel, in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. And they will live securely. But look at what it says. For then his greatness will stretch towards the ends of the earth. His greatness will reach to the ends of the earth. You see, Jesus' kingdom isn't just for Israel, but it's for all. It's for all people. It's to reach to the ends of the earth. A kingdom that will get rid of all evil, all death, all injustice, all poverty. A kingdom that is for all. The future king's coming for everyone. If you read Amos, which comes just before Micah, and some of his prophecies, it talks about this very inclusive, this kingdom and this king, this future king coming for everybody. That's good news for you and for me if you're watching this and you're not Jewish, if you're not from Israel, because that means we're included. It stretches to the ends of the earth. This is a much bigger picture of Jesus, the Messiah, as our future king. He's the king of all creation. Not just part of it, but for all creation. He's come once, and he's the future king who is coming again to fully establish his kingdom. This is the other edge of Advent and this season. It's the waiting for Jesus at Christmas to come, but it's the waiting for his future return as well. And it's going to be good when he comes back. It's going to be so good. I was reading earlier this week Psalm 96 that talks about when what it's going to be like when Jesus, when the King returns. And it says this in Psalm 96, "Let the heavens rejoice, let the earth be glad, let the sea resound and all that is in it, let the fields be jubilant and everything in them, let all the trees of the forest sing for joy, let all creation rejoice before the Lord, for he comes. He comes to judge the earth, he will judge the world in righteousness and the peoples in his faithfulness." It's an incredible picture of our future King coming back, fully establishing his kingdom to the ends of the earth. The seas resounding, the fields jubilant. And I love this picture, the trees are going to sing for joy. All creation will rejoice. He's going to come back and he's going to judge and he's going to do it in the right way. And he's going to be faithful. It's an amazing picture. When Jesus comes back, the trees are going to sing. Now you may be watching this and you might say, well Mark, that's just a picture. That's just symbolic. It's not really what's going to happen. It's just a picture of what it could be like. But it's not really going to happen. Well, I'd say to your response to that, well why not? Why do you think this is just symbolic? Why couldn't this happen when Jesus returns and the future King comes back? You see, all creation is made for Jesus. It was made by him and made for him. We're made to worship God, and that includes trees. We're made to worship the future King. And you and I are as well. It's our purpose. It's the reason that we're here. We're made by the King. We're made for the King. Nothing is here by accident or by chance. Our lives have meaning. And one day, the King is coming back. And his kingdom will be fully established. And all creation, again, like a compass, will turn to him as the true north and will respond to him as King. Now we read in the Bible that one day every knee will bow down. Why? Well, because one day everyone's going to realise that he is King. You see, we're not created to be our own lords and masters. We're created to make Jesus our King. And until we do that, and until we realise that he's our King, or until he returns one day and all people realise that he's our King, we don't fulfil the reason we're created. Tim Keller, the Christian leader in America and writer and great Bible teacher, he talks about this, and he talks about a fish, taking a fish out of water and putting it on dry land. And a fish on dry land, what will it do? Well, it will just flip around a little bit. It will look really ungainly, and eventually it will die. Why? Because it's not created to be on the ground, it's created to be in the water. In the water, it can swim, it can go fast, it can do incredible things. On dry land, it can't. Or an acorn. You know, if you take an acorn and sit it on your windowsill, Tim Keller writes, it will just sit there, and eventually it will shrivel up and die. Plant it in the ground, and it's got everything in it to become an oak tree. Why is it created? To become an oak tree. On your windowsill, it will not fulfil its purpose. You and I don't fulfil our purpose until we make Jesus our King. We're not living the life that God has created for us. We're created to plunge ourselves into the lordship, into the kingship of Jesus, so that we can fulfill our purpose. And when trees do that, when trees recognize God as King, when he comes back one day, they sing. Imagine what you and I can do when we turn and we recognize that Jesus is King and Lord. Imagine what happens in your life and my life when we do that. Jesus is our ancient King. Jesus is our future King as well. But he's our King today as well. We don't have to wait to make him our King. We can recognise him as our King. So how do we do that? How do we recognise? How do we make Jesus our King right now? Now the first thing I think we can do is we can obey his word. If somebody's our King, we obey his word. You know, in the Christmas story that we're going to be remembering in just a couple of weeks' time, we read about Mary and Joseph, and they are people, there's a couple there who made God their King. They made Jesus their King. They obey his words. You know, when the angel comes to Mary and says, I know you're not married and I know you're a virgin, but you're going to give birth to God's son. What does Mary say? She says, well, I'm the Lord's servant. She obeys his word. And when Joseph questions and thinks, well, I'm meant to be marrying Mary, but she's pregnant and the child isn't mine. And it says in the Bible that he makes plans to quietly to divorce her, to break off the engagement. God comes to him in the form of an angel and speaks to Joseph in a dream. And he does what God tells him. He takes her as his wife. If we want to obey, if we want to make Jesus our King, we need to do the same. We need to obey what he's saying to us. And we're not always good at that. You see, sometimes I think we negotiate with God rather than obeying his word. And you don't negotiate with a king. You do what the king says. You know, I remember my children are growing up now, but we still get this sometimes. And perhaps as a parent, you've had this. You tell your children to do something and they say, well, why? Why? Why should I? Why should I do that? What are they really saying there? Their children are saying, well, I'll obey you if you can explain to me why I should. It has to make sense, they're saying to us as parents. Tell me what's going on. Let it make sense to me, and then I'll decide whether to do it or not. That's not really obedience, is it? That's negotiation. And I wonder if sometimes we do that with God. He tells us to do something. He asks us to do something in his word. And we go, well, it's not really convenient. Or could you explain that to me? Could you make it fit first? Could you help me to understand what it is you're asking me to do, God? And then I'll obey you. Did Mary and Joseph like it, what they were being asked to do? No. Did it make sense to them? Did they understand it? No, but they knew that God was King. They knew that he had authority. And so they were going to obey him. Jesus is our ancient King. He's our future King. If we really want him to be King in our lives, we need to obey what he's saying to us. And secondly, just another thought on this, and this is the final thought. When we want to make Jesus our King, we stop worrying and we start expecting him in our lives to move. Now you might be thinking, well, what's worry got to do with Jesus being my King? Well, it's got a lot. It's got a lot to do with it. Martin Luther, the Christian leader, had a friend who he worked with called Philip Melanchthon. And Philip was a worrier. Philip had anxiety, and if you read about Martin Luther's life, you'll read about Philip and just the concerns and the worries he had about ministry and other things. And in a lot of the reports of their relationship, Martin Luther would often go up to Philip when he was worrying, when he was stressed, when he was anxious, and he would put his hand on Philip's shoulder and he would say, let Philip cease to rule the world. Let Philip cease to rule the world. You see, worry is essentially you and I saying, I know how my world should work out. I know how history should play out. I know what should happen and when it should happen. And worry really says, I don't quite trust God to get it right. Worry is essentially, when we boil it down, is you and I wanting to rule our worlds. Now listen, I don't want to give you a hard time if you worry. We all worry. I worry about things sometimes. But when we recognise that worry is coming into our lives, we can stop and we can turn to God and we can look to him and we can say, look, I don't know why this is happening. I don't know how things are going to turn out. But God, you do, because you are my king. You are in charge. You know what is best. And so I'm going to trust you, my ancient king. I'm going to trust you, my future king. I'm going to trust you, my king, right now, to do what is best. And we expect in that God to move and to work things out. There's that lovely bit again in the Christmas story where the angel comes to Mary and tells her that her cousin Elizabeth is going to have a baby, and says, because with God nothing's impossible. Some translations say with God all things are possible. We expect God to move as our king, our powerful, strong, ancient king, future king, and king for right now. We stop worrying. We say, I'm not ruling this situation, you are. And we expect him to move, because with God, all things are possible. Incredible passage we've looked at from Micah today. What does it tell us? That Jesus is our ancient king. He's our true north that we're all trying to find. We recognise him in so many places. He's our future king. He's coming back to establish his kingdom. And we find our purpose and fulfillment in life when we make him our king. And how do we do that? We can obey his word to us, even if we don't understand it, even if we don't quite get it. And we can do that when we stop worrying, stop trying to rule our lives, and when we expect him to move.